You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. New Yorker, Washington correspondent Ryan Lizza has been covering major political developments for almost 20 years. He joins us now to discuss one of the stranger stories of recent American politics, Anthony Scaramucci's late-night call and subsequent firing, and how that fits into the ongoing saga of an administration that's through the looking glass. What is it like when your tweet prompts a call from the new and now former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci? What happens when the general fires the mooch under the nose of the Donald? And why is Mike Pence scheduling so many political events? Ryan Lizza, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. Good to talk to you again.
You too. So Anthony Scaramucci was fired, what, just over a week ago?
Yeah, it was Monday because I remember I was eating a lobster roll in Maine trying to take a day off when my phone exploded and I had to put down the lobster roll and go back to my computer and write a piece about it.
Now, what did you think when you looked at your phone and saw who was calling?
So that was the previous Wednesday.
Okay.
And let me tell you the backstory if you care to hear it.
Yeah.
So Wednesday during the day, I had heard that President Trump was having dinner with Sean Hannity from Fox News, and Bill Fox News executive, who's sort of best
Bill
friends
Shine.
With Hannity, Bill Shine, yeah. And then I heard that Scaramucci was also going to be at that dinner. And I didn't think that was a dramatic scoop in terms of like Trump administration scoop.
Right.
That's a pretty small one. So I confirmed it with a couple of people at the White House and just sent out a tweet saying, "Hey, I learned this little interesting thing. We use Twitter for that as reporters. We use Twitter for things like that all the time, things that are well short of an actual article." I sort of thought nothing of it. Was at home putting my kids to bed. And then I got a call, actually. I don't know if I've told this part of the story, although I think she's talked about it. I got a call from a media reporter at Politico, Hadass Gold.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Scaramucci had called her trying to get my phone number.
Oh.
Because she had inquired to Scaramucci about the dinner with Hannity. She's a media reporter, so it was something she was interested in. She asked Scaramucci about it. Scaramucci said, told her, "Why? How did you know that?" And she said, "Well, it was tweeted out by Ryan Lizza." "Oh, give me Ryan's phone number right now." And so she called and gave me a heads up. Anthony Scaramucci's going to be calling you. So I sort of put my kids to bed and was ready and just sort of waiting for him to call. And he did. He called, and we talked for 8 minutes and 41 seconds.
8 minutes and 41 expletive-laden, wildly imaginative in some of the things he said, conversation.
Yeah, your producer reminded me before I came on that we weren't allowed to say most of the things.
Oh, yeah. There used to be a list here of all the words that you can't say on air. And I do recall at least three of the words that Scaramucci used
are on that list. We'll have to call it the Scaramucci list now. That's the Carlin list.
So the thing that made this story so spectacular in not a good way, it's not just the language that Scaramucci used with you. It was the title he held when he was using that language with you.
Yeah, and it was a very unusual conversation. I mean, first in that I didn't understand why he was set off by the fact that I had reported something so trivial, this dinner at the White House. And there were enough people at that dinner where it would surely become a public,
right.
It would be known to the public. And frankly, the White House, it's very common for them, if you call them and say, "Hey, I heard Trump's having dinner with so-and-so," for them to, "All right, I'll look into that. Yes, it's true. No, it's not true." It's pretty common for them to confirm that kind of thing. It's almost routine, believe it or not. And so it was unusual that set him off so much, but we got on the phone and there was barely a hello. It was,
"Don't use the words
to you?" No, this was actually something that was completely innocent. He said, "Who leaked that to you?" The conversation started with the White House communications director really interrogating me about how I knew about the dinner. That was what he, that was like the first couple of minutes. And that's when he did something very strange. When, you know, I told him, so like, look, Anthony, I can't tell you that. I told the two, I could tell you as much as I'm allowed to tell you. They're two White House sources, but, you know, they told me this, without anonymously. I agreed that I wouldn't name them. So I explained to him, you know, why that's an important thing to protect. And he said, you know, that's when he said, well, you're not going to be protecting anyone because I'm going to fire the entire communication staff tomorrow.
Right. He just sort of went scorched earth on you from moment one, from asking you to reveal your sources to threatening to fire the entire White House press shop if you didn't give him the information that he wanted. The other thing about Scaramucci, in addition to that phone call, was the just how much he sort of reflected the president's personality. In how we see it displaying itself on Twitter over the last couple of days, particularly yesterday with 12 or 13 tweets, and he's up to, I think, two now. I am live monitoring as we're talking, Ryan, the president's Twitter feed. But Scaramucci's audacious kneecapping style is something that the president actually really liked.
Oh, to be sure. If you saw his famous press conference when he was first hired, and that was a really unusual day because he sort of had a secret meeting with Trump, essentially, that cut out and the chief of staff, and, you know, he sort of had to appeal right to Trump personally to get that job as communications director, and then was hired over the objections of a lot of senior people in the White House, including the chief of staff and the senior strategist. And then he comes out and does that press conference, and as a lot of people have remarked, it's a very Trumpian press conference in terms of its sort of, you know, just in terms of his personal presentation. And he did the thing that a lot of Trump aides seem to do, his just over-the-top praise of the president and going on about, the, you know, those kind of bizarre examples he used about Trump, you know, throwing a spiral through a tire. So he was... he was definitely a showman, and the reporting was that Trump really liked it. Trump liked the praise. Trump liked the fact that he put on a good show, that he looked good in a suit, that he was smooth and polished, perhaps unlike Sean Spicer. So his first few days in the White House, he was riding high. Mm-hmm. You know, with the danger with this, you know, it's a double-edged sword with Trump. He wants people who go on TV and are effective and look good, of course, and get high marks. But at the same time, he doesn't want them to overshadow him. So you have to be very careful. There was one piece, I think Politico reported a quote from Trump, who said after Scaramucci came back inside from the briefing, he said, "I'd be really worried if you were 6 inches taller," which is like a classic Trump comment. You know, it's like, you did a great job, but now I'm going to cut you down by pointing out that you're shorter than me and you'll never be as good as me.
Right. And another, the kiss of death from the president is when he says, "Hey, you're almost as famous as I am," which is what he said about Jim Comey, which is what he said. He said that about someone else.
That's when you know you're on your way out.
Yeah, you are definitely you are pretty much gone. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, talking with New Yorker staff writer Ryan Lizza about his infamous phone call with Anthony Scaramucci a little more than almost 2 weeks ago, I guess. Let me ask you this before we move on to Scaramucci's firing. Do you ever wonder if he basically just drunk dialed you?
Oh, to be sure. I have thought about that, and a lot of people have pointed that out, because he was at a dinner at the White House, and I have no idea how festive everyone was being at that dinner.
Was it at the White House, or was it at the White House, or was he at Trump International?
No. My understanding is the dinner itself
was at the White House.
At the White House, and whether. I probably shouldn't say because I haven't confirmed this. I have heard that some of the folks at that dinner later were, you know, the sort of evening continued at another restaurant. Mm-hmm. But the short answer is I've thought of that, and a lot of people have raised that with me because it was such an unusual, over-the-top conversation.
Right.
But I don't know, and obviously I didn't ask him. I'll tell you one thing. This is one thing I don't think I've told anyone else this. I've said this privately to a lot of people. one of the things that, as I was listening to him go off on Reince Priebus, go off on Steve Bannon, make these kind of silly threats that he was going to fire the whole White House staff, to me, on the other end of the phone, I thought, is he in front of someone else for whom he is performing?
Uh-huh.
You ever talk to someone, or even do it yourself, then there's someone else in the room, and you're acting maybe a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask him if he was around anyone else, but I will say when I was on the phone, that's what I was thinking. I was like, who is he showing off for right now by going on these, you know, these kind of wild tangents?
Well, you know what, Ryan, that's actually a very good train of thought. And let me ask you, had you ever interviewed Scaramucci face-to-face, just the two of you in a room?
I've been on the set with him at CNN. I first met him because we were just both on a panel one night on CNN, and I've only done real interviews with him over the phone,
mm-hmm.
and they were nothing like the ones that I reported on last week, and in person, and just conversations I've had with him over text. It was not the same level of use of vulgarities or, you know, really, really going after people the way he did. It was unusual. The interactions I've had with him previously in person, over the phone, and over text were not really like that.
You know, that's a very good, a very good point, because as we know from, you know, observing the president and reporting on the president, we know that people who go to that podium in the briefing room, they are performing for an audience of one, whether it was Sean Spicer, whether it's Sarah Huckabee Sanders, whether it was Scaramucci, whether it was Stephen Miller, who I want to talk to you about in a minute. They couldn't care less about the people in the room who they're supposed to be talking to, or the person on the other end of the phone, if they know the boss is watching.
Exactly. I don't know if you're asking me, do I think Trump was the person in the room?
I mean, it's a reasonable
question. I really don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. But I know exactly what you mean. It is very true. Everyone who goes, I think most, if you are to be a close observer and student of this administration, it often helps to watch Trump surrogates on TV and remind yourself that this person in the back of their mind is thinking about their place in Trump world and what the president is thinking about their performance right now. And very, you know, you see this with the vice president very frequently. It just seems like he's always, you know, that audience of one you talked mm-hmm. about is the president. So I don't think, you know, I don't think he was. I thought, so you know, there were no ground rules for the conversation. And to me, you know, so I don't know that he expected me to write up the interview. And when I talked to him the next day to tell him that, look, Anthony, you're the communications director at the White House, this was a, you know, we didn't set any ground rules. It's a presumptively on-the-record mm-hmm. conversation, and I'm going to write it up. He was not happy about that, which suggests... Well, I was just going to say, suggests that he was being, you know, he was being a little careless with a reporter, and
right.
maybe, you know, didn't want this stuff published, or at least the next day had second thoughts.
Right, and the thing that folks need to keep in mind is when you are talking, you meaning you or myself or any reporter talking to someone that high up in the administration, even though there were no ground rules set, the presumption is it is on the record, unless
Absolutely.
unless that person says flat out, the very first words out of their mouth are, this is off the record, or this is on background.
Absolutely. It's he's the spokesperson for the White House. My job as a reporter is to report on what people at the White House are thinking and doing. And when you have a conversation with the spokesperson for the White House, with where that person initiated the call, and you start interviewing them about important figures mm-hmm. in the White House, and they start telling you extremely newsworthy things, like the fact that he called the FBI on the chief of staff, it would be journalistically extremely unethical to suppress that news, to suppress that conversation, to not report it.
Right.
And, you know, we had a conversation the next day at the New Yorker. Okay, what do we have here? Was it Was it off the record? No. Did you record it so we know we have absolute, you know, faithful rendering of the quotes? Yes. And then it was, well, what would possibly be the justification for not reporting this news? And, you know, maybe, you know, someone said, well, you know, your relationship with the White House, or at least with Scaramucci, is really going to suffer if he, you know. And, well, yeah, but that's not a good enough reason, or even a reason, not to, you know, to suppress the news in the interview. And so that was not a very difficult decision.
Right. And listeners should know that they can go to the New Yorker's website and hear the actual audio from that phone conversation between Anthony Scaramucci, the now former White House Communications Director, and Ryan Lizza. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Ryan Lizza, the New Yorker staff writer, about his political reporting, his now famous phone call with the Mooch, and the White House crises that have ensued ever since. We'll be right back after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate and speaking with Ryan Lizza, the New Yorker staff writer who had that infamous phone call with Anthony Scaramucci, and has been covering Washington for many, many years. And as we discussed before the break, Ryan, that was unlike any phone conversation that you have had, and probably one of the more consequential, because as a result of it, Anthony Scaramucci, who had just been named White House Communications Director for a mere 10 days, was shown the door.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, his tenure was very short-lived. You know, people after the piece was published that documented the phone call, people would ask me, do you think that he's going to get fired? And I would say, with Trump, you know, you never know. He's either going to get fired or he's going to get promoted.
Right.
And, you know, you just don't know. And that was such a tumultuous few days in the White House, because you had Scaramucci coming in, and that really angered the chief of staff.
Reince Priebus.
And, yeah, it's really unusual to hire a communications director that your chief of staff vehemently opposes. I mean, I don't know. I guess I can't say that's unprecedented, but the chief of staff is the guy. You know, he runs the White House,
right?
And to bring someone in over his objections, I mean, that made it clear to me that there's no way that these two guys can work together and survive. One of them was going to leave, and then of course, once the Scaramucci interview happened with me, where he, you know, called Priebus a paranoid schizophrenic, a paranoiac, and some other, you know, and some other things we can't say, one of them had to go. It was clear. And of course, in that interview, Scaramucci told me that Reince would be gone imminently, and he was right.
Right.
So the shocking thing was that it was, even after the interview, it was Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, who was pushed out. So that happened. And then I don't know if Scaramucci saw this coming, but of course the new chief of staff, his first move was to say, wait a second, do I really want a communications director who maybe isn't so good at communicating? And by the way, the last chief of staff, you know, he was at war with.
Right.
And so I think Kelly was sending a message there by firing Scaramucci on his first day.
Right. The other thing about Scaramucci is that not only was he hired over the objections of Reince Priebus, then the chief of staff, but Scaramucci made it clear that he was not reporting to the chief of staff, which is what happens under so-called regular order. He was reporting directly to the president of the United States.
Yeah, that was unusual. And as you know, and in my interview with him, he made a point of saying Reince didn't get the message. And what he meant by that was they put out a press release. It said that Scaramucci would report to the president, not through the chief of staff to the president, as a normal White House would have it. And Scaramucci said to me, you know, Reince didn't get the message. In other words, Reince should have resigned. He was overruled on this big hire that Scaramucci is not even reporting to him. Reince should realize that the writing is on the wall and push and leave. And, you know, Trump does have it, it's funny because Trump has this, you know, of course, his reputation from The Apprentice is all about being you're fired. When in reality, Trump has a tough time confronting people and firing them. He's not actually good at that, but you know, he likes to sort of push them aside, you know, layer over them mm-hmm. with other staffers, you know, give them hints until they resign. You know, I guess you're being layered over wouldn't have been as a catchy a tagline for The Apprentice.
Well, hey, Ryan, here's the thing. So now he hires General Kelly, who is the Secretary of Homeland Security, brings him in as Chief of Staff. It's as if the president did a 180. Here's this guy who goes out, has a conversation with you that the president loves, goes out to the briefing room and gives a performance that the president loves, and yet he brings in someone who removes Scaramucci and sets about sending some order in the place. I guess I and a lot of people in the country are wondering, how long is General Kelly going to, one, be able to impose order on a White House that has resisted it for so long? And two, how long will he remain in that job when he realizes that the one person who needs to be controlled is beyond his control?
Yeah, so I have a couple of thoughts on this. One, and I always said this during the campaign because, you know, as political reporters, we do obsess about staffing changes and the soap opera of staffing, and it does matter. Having a dysfunctional process matters for policy and matters for getting things right in the world. But at the same time, we can exaggerate how much staffing changes will change Donald Trump or this White House. I mean, it can't be much worse. They really seem to have a very dysfunctional process over there. So the fact that they have a more normal chief of staff who's empowered the way the traditional chiefs of staff have been empowered, that's probably a good thing for the process. But Trump is at the heart of what is wrong at the White House, and especially in terms of communications and messaging and ability to get things done in Washington. The reason that their legislative agenda doesn't get much push or from the White House, the reason that their communications strategy week in, week out is so haphazard and random and not sort of disciplined the way it was in the Obama era and the Bush era, is because the president isn't disciplined, and he is his own communications director and very often his own chief of staff. He's a micromanager of the White House in a way that we haven't had since Carter. People forget this, but one of the big criticisms of Carter is the way he micromanaged the White House. I mean, Trump makes Carter look like Eisenhower, you know, being above it all and not paying attention to anything. I mean, so I agree with you that Kelly will run into the same problems that other people have run into when they're working for Trump. The first thing, when you're communicating for Trump, the first problem you have is you will be asked to defend things that are false. You will be asked to defend, you know, a series of statements that Trump has made that are just not true. And every new person that speaks for him eventually gets the list of big lies Trump has told this year about voter fraud, about the size of his inauguration crowd, about whether Barack Obama tapped the phones at Trump Tower, right? There's this series of kind of wild statements he's made that Sean Spicer and Sarah Huckabee Sanders have had to defend. And it doesn't matter what your reputation is, as soon as you step in and you have to defend those things, and there will be more, you've lost your credibility. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, number one, is the number one staffing problem that any senior Trump person has, mm-hmm. is just they are going to be asked to defend things that are not true, and you won't be able to stay in Trump's employment unless you do it, and if you do it, you're going to damage your credibility.
Yeah. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker. We're talking about Scaramucci, General Kelly, President Trump, the insanity that is the Trump administration's West Wing. Ryan, I want to run through as many things as we can in the 10 minutes that we have. One, the story in the New York Times about Mike Pence, Vice President Pence, setting up his own PAC. He's made trips that look like political fundraising or campaigning. The vice president pushed back on those stories that he's, you know, waging along with a bunch of other Republicans, sort of a covert campaign for the presidency as soon as 2020. What do you make of those reports? And to my mind, they ring true. What do you think?
Well, Well, all right. So funny. So when we get off the phone, I have to finish a piece about this that I'm late for. I'm late on.
Well, I appreciate your time.
So, and one thing that will be in that piece, I don't want to scoop myself, but there'll be one of the only newsworthy quotes that I left on the cutting room floor from that Scaramucci interview was something he said about Pence, and that'll be in the piece. So I'll have to leave that as a way to get listeners to go to.
I wish we had the sound effect of the dun dun dun, because I mean.
I don't want to exaggerate, okay. But it is. It's sort of his view of what Pence's view of the dysfunctional White House was.
Oh, okay.
And you know, one of the things I've been reporting on as soon as I saw that Time story is just comparing it to previous vice presidents and how they acted. Mm-hmm. And the example that I think is really instructive is Al Gore and Clinton. Now, the dynamic with Pence and Trump is underlying it is. This is an unstable presidency, and a lot of people think at some point Trump might not make it, and Pence could have to step in, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of people, either Trump will decide not to run, or,
Or other things.
Will he be impeached? Will he resign? I mean, those are in the realm of those are all non-zero probabilities.
Right.
And so, obviously, Pence, being a smart political actor, has to be thinking about that. When Bill Clinton was actually being impeached, he had an iron rule about both in public and in private in never seeming eager to take over, in making sure that he supported Clinton at every turn, and just didn't want anyone to think that he was anxious for to step into Clinton's shoes, or push him to resign or anything like that. So. The fact that I haven't confirmed any of the Times reporting, but I trust it's accurate. The fact that has been doing all these political activities mm-hmm. just seems so ham-handed and sort of shocking. So, and everything he's done since then has been to sort of placate Trump and to sort of back down from this and make mm-hmm. sure that the boss doesn't think he's actually, walking into the residence every day, checking his pulse.
Putting the mirror under his nose to see if it fogs up. Let's talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions. For a while there were reports that the president was going after him in tweets, and those have seemed to die down. Is Jeff Sessions safe?
It's interesting. I feel like all of his senior people go through these phases where he publicly berates them. Stories leak out of the White House that they're about to be fired. And then they either sort of, they back down, they lower their public profile, and the reign of terror against them ends, and they stick around. Mm-hmm. I mean, Steve Bannon is a good example of this. He's gone through several waves of Trump being mad at him, but has sort of survived all the shakeup. And I feel like Sessions has now he survived, a week or 2 weeks of Trump publicly berating him, but without actually taking any action. Now, maybe he was trying to get Sessions to resign. Sessions hung tough. He's been around Trump almost probably longer than any politician, right?
He was the first in the Senate.
He was the first senator to back him, so he saw all these staffing changes. He understands how Trump works. So my guess is that he has now survived. And the other thing is, if Trump's end goal by attacking Sessions was to somehow trigger a chain of events that would get the special counsel, Robert Mueller, fired, it didn't really make sense.
Yeah.
Because if Sessions had resigned or been fired, you would have had a Senate even Republicans would have been extremely uncomfortable with that. He would have had a lot of time finding a new attorney general that one would take the job or two would be confirmed. It wouldn't affect Ron Rosenstein, who actually is the person that is overseeing Mueller. And so anyway, if he had an end goal in mind there, it didn't seem well thought out.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about Robert Mueller in the time that we have left. Before the Senate adjourned, four senators dropped two bills, all designed to send a message to the White House that don't you even think for one moment you are going to fire Robert Mueller while we are out of town. What do you make of where the investigation is? And particularly, I'm thinking of the news that broke. I believe that was what I've taken to calling Fresh Hell Friday. yes. Something always happens on Friday. That he has impaneled, there's a grand jury in Washington, D.C. proper, that's separate from the one that was already on ongoing in Alexandria, Virginia, just across the Potomac. What do you make of that, and what does that say about where things are in the investigation or investigations?
Yeah, I wrote a piece about this last week and talked to some former federal prosecutors, and a couple of things are important. One, it means that there is a predicated investigation. In other words, there are specific parts of the criminal code that Mueller has decided there is likely evidence of criminal conduct that have violated those codes. So this is a predicated investigation. You don't just open up a grand jury to launch a fishing investigation, fishing expedition, right? You know, if Mueller just thinks that you saw you on TV one night and didn't like you, you can't just set up a grand jury and start subpoenaing information about Jonathan Capehart.
Well, thank God for that.
To find out if you committed a crime. He's got to have some evidence to get the ball rolling, right? Mm-hmm. He's got to have a specific crime in mind. So it's a predicated investigation. That's one thing that's important. And then basically a grand jury can do three things. It starts with subpoenaing documents, gathering evidence, and then once sufficient amounts of evidence and documents are gathered, he will likely start calling witnesses who will offer testimony. Now, some prosecutors argue to me that, you use a grand jury for witnesses that might be a little more hostile because you want to lock in their testimony in a formal setting with a transcribed where they're sworn in and the testimony is transcribed. So possibly Mueller has in the back of his mind some witnesses whose testimony he wants to lock in. And then, so subpoenaing documents, getting witnesses in there, and then finally it can issue indictments. Now, it doesn't mean we don't know. We don't have enough visibility into the grand jury to know how far it will go. We learned recently, in April, there was a report that the Clinton email investigation, that there was a grand jury impaneled to, subpoena some records. Now, that grand jury doesn't seem like it was used very much. It certainly didn't issue indictments. So grand juries can be impaneled for specific reasons, and, then there are no indictments and no criminal charges filed. We don't know yet. We don't know how serious this is, but all of the reporting, the size of the staff that Mueller has hired, the fact that there are two grand juries, the fact that we know from the people who he is subpoenaing that a lot of subpoenas are going out, it means that it seems to be a fairly significant, large-scale investigation with predicates.
And the caliber of people Mueller is hiring is also a sign. They say where there's smoke, there's fire. We don't know if there's a fire, but one thing we do know, smoke can kill you. I am Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker, thank you so much for being on the show today, talking about his famous phone call with Anthony Scaramucci and the seemingly never-ending White House crises. Again, Ryan, thank you very much for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Jonathan. Anytime.